Russia is hoping that Azerbaijan and Armenia will adhere to a ceasefire it has helped negotiate following the deadly flare-up at the border. President Putin doubles down on Russia's resolve to move its economy away from the US dollar. And the UK police is facing criticism for the arrest of anti-royalist protesters following the new king's accession to the throne. Hello and welcome to World News. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, a ceasefire is holding after deadly clashes erupted between Armenia and Azerbaijan on Monday night over the disputed border. Both sides agreed to stop exchange of fire this morning under a Russian-brokered truce. Moscow now says it remains extremely concerned and hopes the ceasefire holds. Both Baku and Yerevan accuse one another for the flare-up. Both reported casualties too. Azerbaijan is yet to offer the details, with Armenia putting its death toll at 49. Meanwhile, Iran's president has called any new war unacceptable. Ebrahim Raisi said in a phone call with Armenia's Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan that Iran is closely watching the developments. Raisi called for a negotiated settlement to the tensions. Armenia and Azerbaijan have fought several battles since their 2020 war over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. President of the Asia Institute, Emmanuel Pastrich, earlier told us about the possible role Iran can play to end the conflict.
Iran and Turkey can play. I mean, Turkey has, I think, not played such a positive role so far. Iran, in a way, has greater trust with Armenia and has, of course, the cultural ties with Azerbaijan that could make all the difference. The war before, what's really changed is in the Nagorno-Karabakh region, the previous conflict in the 90s and really until recently, Russia has been neutral, has tried to stay out, whereas now I think Russia really has no choice if NATO is trying to muscle in and get control of oil and gas there, then these interests overwhelm all the smaller ones. And sadly, geopolitical conflicts can overwhelm the interests of the particular countries involved. That's why we really need a country, perhaps Iran, perhaps others, who are willing to try and step back from this escalating conflict between Russia and NATO and try and get back to talking about people, talking about long-term interests.
Russia's President Vladimir Putin says the global economy will inevitably cut the US dollar out of its transactions. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed whether the strategy of de-dollarization can help Russia eliminate financial obstacles caused by Western sanctions. Welcome to our news review program. Russia's president says it's inevitable for the global economy to replace the US dollar with other currencies in its transactions. Vladimir Putin says his country is doing well despite what he called external financial and technological aggression. He was referring to the sanctions Western countries have imposed on Russia over the war in Ukraine. Putin added that Russia managed to stabilize inflation and prevent a sharp decline in the economy despite the bans. Moscow has been pushing a de-dollarization strategy over the past months. It is a reaction to the cutting Russia's central bank from the dollar in its transactions. Well, in order to dig a little deeper, we have our guests joining us, Aina Tangen, economic analyst from Beijing, and Steve Keen, economist and author from Sydney. Welcome to you, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining us. First of all, I'll go over to Steve Keen, as it seems like we have a poor connection in Beijing. Steve, please tell us, is the de-dollarization only a symbolic move, or will Russia be able to actually use it as a tool to offset the vast financial sanctions it's facing?
Well, it's possibly, it's feasible for another currency system to be developed for international trade. It wouldn't just be the Russian ruble, it would be the Chinese one and a few other countries that are willing to make up a basket of commodities to back an international currency for things like oil, coal, bulk commodities and so on. So it's quite feasible, and it's something I wish would happen, frankly, because one of the major reasons for all the catastrophes in the post-World War II period was the American delegation at Bretton Woods, led by Harvey Dexter White, insisting that rather than having a neutral currency created as a basket of all commodities, which was Keynes's idea, called the Bancor, they should use the US dollar. Now, that gave the US financial sector incredible power. It also weakened the American manufacturing sector, and it is now being used as a weapon by America in political conflicts. And that is, it is just the wrong way to use the financial sector, where above all, the financial sector must function. Otherwise, capitalism breaks down.
I will ask you this, Keen. Russia is not alone in the plan to de-dollarize. Of course, we've heard that Iran and China are also moving towards the elimination of the dollar. Even the BRICS countries have been discussing multilateral currencies. How do you think the possibility of an independent economic architecture eventually challenging the Western financial hegemony?
I think it's fairly likely, and I'd like to see it happen. As I've said, the huge trade imbalances we have largely been caused by the American dollar being used for international trade rather than the scheme that Keynes wanted. So if we have these countries coming together to develop a new international currency, hopefully they can learn from Keynes's wisdom in his proposals for the Bancor and give us a currency like that and get away from the crazy hegemony of the American dollar.
Countries are already reducing the share of the US dollar by diversifying their foreign exchange reserve. Does this mean the geopolitical weight is also declining in addition to its economic dominance?
I think so, but their power is still quite immense. So they will fight tooth and nail against this. They'll do things like ban the use of SWIFT, for example, for that currency. So they will continue behaving badly to try to hang on to their own power. But I would urge Russia, China, the countries considering producing a new international currency to do it. It's the only way you get reform is by a breakaway group.
Thank you so much, Steve. We are rejoined by Einar Tangen. Thank you very much for joining us, Einar. Let me ask you this, which I already asked Steve. Russia is not alone in de-dollarizing, and the plan has been mentioned by China and Iran as well. How do you see things moving forward, and is this a symbolic gesture, or will it actually materialize?
Well, it is materializing. I do agree with Steve that this is about trust. The U.S. has, in essence, become a monetary bully, and it's not reflecting well. It's not only what's happened to Russia, China, in terms of trade war, this could morph into a currency war, but also what happened in Afghanistan, this idea that you can seize other people's money simply because it's within your system. This has been taken note by many other countries, and that is one of the reasons that everybody is rethinking their strategies in terms of the reserves. It's not, and I agree, it's not going to be an immediate process, but people are looking for safer alternatives.
Right, so do you think that gradually the dollar will lose its power and basically the de-dollarization plan will challenge the U.S.'s hegemony in the world?
Yes, I mean, the loss of the dollar hegemony would be catastrophic to the U.S. The U.S. has built up immense, amounts of debt that has been so far financed by very cheap dollars coming into the U.S. By virtue of its hegemony position. But as that goes away, the U.S. is going to have to compete. You know, everybody right now is running towards the dollar. They forget that at a certain point, everyone will be running away from it as they look for other areas. The U.S. economy is not strong. And these increased rates are going to have an internal toll as people's economies slow down, as people stop buying houses, these types of things. And it's going at a certain point, it all shifts away and the hourglass turns in the opposite direction and everybody is trying to figure out a way out. So if I was in that area, I would certainly be hedging at least 6 months out.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining us. Aina Tangen, economic analyst from Beijing, and Steve Keen, economist and author from Sydney. Thanks to the both of you for sharing your insights. I really appreciate it. And on that note, we've come to the end of our news review program. Moving on, Germany is drawing out draft legislation to provide federal credit assistance to energy companies battered by the energy row with Russia. Germany media cited government officials as saying that Berlin wants to offer guarantees and liquidity assistance to energy firms. This will include credit authorizations of nearly $68 billion. Several European energy firms have requested state support to stay afloat after Russia halted natural gas exports to Europe last week. The latest is German utility EnBW that announced a $560 million loss on Monday. Moscow says the gas flow won't resume until Western sanctions over the war in Ukraine are removed. Russia blames the sanctions for the technical problems that have caused disruptions. Max Civili earlier joined us from Berlin with more details on how Germany is trying to cope amidst Europe's energy crisis.
German government is setting up a credit line to assist utilities that are facing huge problems in supplying energy to Germans. The German Association of Energy and Water Industries sounded the alarm last week. Prices are rising and utilities have no more money to pay the suppliers, and so they need liquidity. Here in Germany, many hundred utilities are in troubles. These are companies owned by municipalities and are a very important part of Germany's power and gas network. There have been increasingly loud calls on the government to do what it can to shield people and businesses from soaring energy prices and growing inflation. Lobby groups have repeatedly said that increasing numbers of businesses are facing existential crisis. Calls to do more have come from the German Chamber of Industry and Trade, and they said that many companies are in fear for the survival.
Civil liberty groups slam British police crackdown on anti-monarchy protesters during the ceremonies to mark the death of Queen Elizabeth. The advocacy group Liberty says it is deeply concerned by the powers given to the police to curb acts of protest. The Global Majority Versus campaign has also condemned what it calls centuries of colonial injustice and genocide in the name of the British Crown. Others are saying that calling for abolition of the monarchy is not a crime. This comes after arrest of several anti-monarchy protesters as royals attended rituals, including in Edinburgh. Earlier, the main anti-monarchy group Republic said support for ending the institution and debate its relevance in the UK has grown since the death of the Queen on Thursday. Earlier, political analyst Said Mohsen Abbas gave us his perspective on the British police response to the anti-monarchy protests.
Even people as kind of benign as protesters against the monarchy are being pulled up on the streets. And of course, this is indicative of where a lot of the direction of Western actual democracy, so-called democracies, are. They're basically going through a transition where a lot of the old rights just won't be there. I mean, they're being eroded slowly but steadily. It'll be very interesting to see how King Charles III deals with any such matters. They do raise the fact that through the Republic, who you quoted earlier, they often raise the fact that the monarchy actually costs Britain around £345 million a year. Their well-wishers would argue that the royal family also attracts tourists and is part of a tourist industry, which also gives Britain something.
On a related note, more Commonwealth countries are asking whether they should keep or ditch the Queen's successor as their head of state. New Zealand's Prime Minister says she supports the idea of shifting the country to a republic, adding, "This is something that will ultimately take place." Jacinda Ardern, however, says a transition would take time. Her Australian counterpart Anthony Albanese has not ruled out a referendum on a republic If he is re-elected in 2025, his government also says it's considering replacing the image of Queen Elizabeth on banknotes with Australian figures.
The priority for us is ensuring the smooth transition of the coins. As I understand it, the decision to include the Queen's face in the $5 note was about her personally rather than about her status as the monarch. So that transition isn't automatic. We'll have a sensible conversation within government and make an appropriate announcement in due course.
Apart from New Zealand and Australia, calls to ditch the British economy are also growing in other Commonwealth nations. Antigua and Barbuda says the island country will hold a referendum on transitioning to a republic in 3 years. Jamaica has also said it's considering independence. The US is hit by its largest ever strike of private sector nurses as some 15,000 healthcare workers join a walkout across Minnesota. The nurses are protesting hospital understaffing and demanding higher wages. The strike is scheduled to last 3 days and will affect 16 hospitals. Negotiations have been ongoing for more than 5 months without reaching an agreement. The strike spotlights nationwide nursing shortages exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic. This has not only put a heavy strain on workers but also led to patients not receiving adequate care. Strikes in the US have occurred regularly over the past year. Employees are reporting to be exhausted by working during the COVID-19 pandemic and struggling with price rises. And on that note, we've come to the end of this news program. Thanks for joining us.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on July 27, 2022.
Give people awareness and insight. These things that I have mentioned are also true for the upcoming Muharram sermons, and you should be able to see the results in the following Friday prayers. So, if what you're doing is successful, you should be able to see it in the people coming to the Friday prayers. If you notice that what you're doing was not effective in attracting a larger audience, there is something wrong with what you're doing. Find those flaws and fix them. We cannot say the reason for this lack of attention is that people have lost their beliefs and have become less religious. Some people say such things. It truly seems they are talking without having thought about what they're saying, and are suggesting that the people have become less religious. No, that's not the case at all. They're not less religious. Just look at the Ghadir celebrations and the massive gatherings for the ceremonies and speeches during the months of Muharram and Safar. Who are the people who attend these ceremonies? They are our people. Look at the morning ceremonies, the religious ceremonies, the Arba'een Wuk. Who are these people? These are our people. Our people's religion, their faith, their belief, not only have they not weakened, they have actually become stronger. However, the quality of my sermons or my prayers might not be good enough to attract these faithful people. This should not be mistaken for weakness in the people's beliefs.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Some people easily say these things. For instance, they say the people's beliefs have weakened. No, they have not weakened. I've seen the country before the revolution. Most of you have not. Our people are holding larger religious ceremonies now. They are making much larger financial contributions to the religious seminaries, and they are participating more actively in social and religious services. The people are present on the scene. We are the ones who need to remain on the scene with them. O Allah, by the blessed souls of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi and his progeny, help what we have said and heard to be for you and in your path. Bless us with sincerity and accept it from us. O Allah, help us to practice the things we preach. Unite the pure soul of our magnanimous Imam who opened this path for us and the blessed souls of the dear martyrs who strived and sacrificed their lives on this path with the pure souls of the first martyrs of Islam and the holy Imam. Bless all of us to join them. May Allah's greetings, mercy and blessings be upon you all.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The events of September 11, 2001 shook the world. People watched across the globe as newsreels showed a Boeing 767 crash into the North Tower of the World Trade Center just before 9 a.m. in what initially appeared to be a terrible accident. When a second plane crashed into the South Tower 18 minutes later, it became clear that this was an attack. A third plane also crashed into the Pentagon just outside Washington, D.C., and a fourth plane crashed into rural Pennsylvania. 3,000 people were immediately killed in these attacks. Al-Qaeda, which was a terrorist network led by bin Laden, was quickly identified as being responsible for the 9/11 attacks, and the Taliban housed Al-Qaeda during those times. Within 10 days of the attacks, U.S. President George W. Bush initiated America's so-called War on Terror and began its invasion of Afghanistan. In 2001, both Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were driven out of the Afghan capital in a matter of months, so the U.S. strategy soon shifted from combat to what it said was stabilizing and rebuilding the country. 10 years after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, President Barack Obama announced that Osama bin Laden was dead, but U.S. troops stayed in the country, mostly supporting the government in Kabul through air power and training Afghan troops. While the U.S. presence seemed fruitful at first, across the rural countryside, support for the Taliban gained ground. This was mainly because of the U.S.'s massive campaign of airstrikes and bombings, much of which have had high civilian death tolls. So in essence, the Taliban had been defeated, yet the American presence brought them back from the dead. In 2021, despite America's longest war in history, the world witnessed Taliban forces sweeping through districts and gaining control of the country, and the U.S. suddenly removing its troops only facilitated the process. All this, from the U.S.'s inability to stabilize the country to its disastrous pullout, has led to questions regarding Washington's aims in Afghanistan and how it truly failed there.
Well, basically, we went into Afghanistan allegedly in response to 9/11 to find bin Laden and to kill him or to bring him to justice. We never did. And when ultimately bin Laden was found, he was not in Afghanistan. When the initial troops had been established there, there was a shift then to what might be called nation building. That is, we felt that Afghanistan should not be a home for terrorism, should not be a safe haven. Therefore, we will transform it in our own image. And this was the first sign of trouble. And we fought a war that went on for 20 years that we ultimately lost, and we withdrew with our tail between our legs as a result of a mistaken policy and a mistaken philosophy to begin with, that we could have changed other countries without knowing anything about their culture, their language, or their way of life. And that was the ultimate mistake. It led to devastation in Afghanistan.
The war on terror began more than 20 years ago by the Bush administration, with the main goal of rooting out terrorism. But the world has witnessed that it has been a complete and utter disaster, and now it is widely believed that it has led to an increase in the number of global terrorist organizations. Reports show that since the US invaded Afghanistan in 2001, terrorist organizations have almost doubled. The so-called War on Terror also gave birth to the U.S. Authorities for Use of Military Force, or the AUMF, a law that has so far drained billions of dollars out of the American people's pockets and reshaped U.S.'s foreign policy. The U.S. also used the AUMF to invade Iraq, but after years of conflict, it seems that this was all essentially a way to provide additional unilateral power to the executive branch, one which allows the U.S. to wage war and engage in conflict across the globe. While the U.S. claimed that it aimed to make the world a safer place, it has in fact done the opposite and made the world much less safe. The U.S. war on terror goes beyond the U.S. failure in Afghanistan. Terrorism has actually endured in the broader West Asia, North Africa, and South Asia regions. Today, the number of attacks and victims worldwide are 3 to 5 times higher annually than in 2001. Yet the safety of the world is now under danger by the country who set out to make the world a safer place, namely the U.S. and its continuing warmongering aspirations. The U.S. is on a war footing with nuclear-armed countries like Russia and China. It has threatened countries like Iran militarily. Thousands dead, millions displaced, and trillions of dollars wasted are all consequences of what the U.S. says is a war on terror.
The so-called war on terror was meant to keep the world safe for, you know, American control over world politics. You saw what happened in Afghanistan. I mentioned with the situation, the war in Iraq, there was a decision made. The use of U.S. military policy simply to ensure control of the United States over the world economy and over the political world is now in danger of becoming a conflict which could really end mankind. So that's the kind of thing we're facing today, and to the extent that people begin to understand that more clearly.
Iran's top general has warned of the ramifications of the growing military coordination between the U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, and the Israeli military, saying the Islamic Republic interprets the development as a direct threat to its national security. Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Baghdadi, wrote in an online message that the terrorist U.S. military has tried to compensate for the withdrawal of its aircraft carriers, helicopter carriers, and destroyers from the Persian Gulf and the Oman Sea by connecting the child-killing Israeli military to CENTCOM.
The meaning of this action is that, from our point of view, the spying and even operational facilities of the United States and its allies will be at the disposal of the occupying Zionist regime, and this will increase the threat to our beloved country.
In his message, Baghdadi also said the regional countries that host American forces have already received written warnings from Iran, which sees the U.S. presence in the region as a serious threat.
In addition to written announcements, warnings, and conveyance of the message through the foreign ministry to countries hosting the U.S. Army, we have declared and will declare our readiness and warning through expanding our presence, including air and sea patrols, deepening our intelligence dominance, and conducting various naval, missile, and drone exercises.
The top Iranian general further said, Iran's friendly advice to neighboring countries is to uphold brotherly relations and cooperation to establish security in the region by our own countries and not by relying on foreigners. Israel moved from U.S. European Command to CENTCOM in September of last year with the aim of simplifying the cooperation with American occupation forces in the region. The move is also expected to expand military coordination between the Israeli regime and sub-Arab countries, which began to normalize their relations with the regime in Tel Aviv under U.S. brokered agreements in late 2020.
So this is really a response by the West, by the U.S., British, Canadian, Australian, Five Eyes military alliance, in an almost nervous reaction to their failed operations in the Middle East, from Afghanistan to Iraq to Libya to Syria, but they're also now seeing their failure in Ukraine, which is going to result in tremendous political uprisings that most likely will overthrow the ruling regimes in Europe. So I think Israel and the United States may very well try and open up a new military front against Syria, against Iran, using Iraq as a proxy, and this is the first step in that strategy.
Late last month, Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, made an unprecedented visit to the headquarters of the U.S. Central Command in Florida. During the visit, Gantz claimed that Israel's cooperation with CENTCOM and the countries of the region is a game-changer in confronting Iran, adding that Israel and the U.S. will continue to deepen cooperation against Iran's peaceful nuclear program, which he charged was aimed at obtaining a nuclear weapon, a baseless accusation that Tehran has time and again rejected. Washington has also been working to improve ties between Israel and its neighbors under the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords. The deal, commonly described as normalizing relations and establishing formal diplomatic ties between the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan, and Israel. At its heart, a business deal, the Abraham Accords facilitated financial investment between the countries as well as military and surveillance cooperation. Palestinian leaders, activists, and ordinary people have repeatedly rejected Arab-Israeli normalization deals as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people.
The shifting political powers in Europe and the world and the Middle East are driving the Israeli reaction. Very clearly, the pendulum of political power is shifting away from the United States and Britain and Israel, and it is shifting into Asia. So you have Russia, India, Iran, China emerging as the powerhouse countries. And Israel recognizes that the Middle Eastern regimes of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, they are all shifting to seek better relations with Russia. That being said, Israel is quickly accelerating its military plans to try and bluff and seem like it is a threat. But I think at heart, it recognizes these Middle Eastern regimes names of the Wahhabi Sunni kingdoms have no political loyalty whatsoever.
Normalization is the way for the current regimes to establish their foundations and fight their peoples by transforming the battle in our region from a struggle for Palestinian and Arab rights to supporting the ambitions and plans of the occupation. In the absence of outlets for oppressed Palestinians to resist and tell their narratives, social media are one of the few tools at their disposal to counter Israeli disinformation campaigns. However, social media platforms, which were once heralded as means of free speech and liberation, have been complicit in the suppression and silencing of pro-Palestinian voices, a practice dubbed digital apartheid by some. Israel's attempts to erase the humanity of the Palestinians or whitewash its crimes against them continue unabated. Facebook's massive media monopoly, rebranded as Meta to save face from years of controversies surrounding it, is one of Israel's favorite ways to censor and control political debate in Palestine. Now, in a fresh crackdown on Palestinian social media content, several platforms owned by Meta have targeted accounts of dozens of pro-Palestinian individuals, including activists, writers, and journalists. Facebook and WhatsApp have closed many accounts for covering Israel's August bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip and reporting on Palestinian civilian deaths. The targeted individuals have raised the alarm over what they describe as unjust suppression of their content. They say the social networking platforms have cited breaching their publishing standards for the crackdown.
I posted a number of photos detailing the civilians killed by Israeli forces in the Gaza Strip on August 17. They then accused me of breaching the publishing standards. But the real reason is clear. It's about cleansing the platforms of Palestinian content.
My first warning came when I published a photo of Adam Nablusi, who was killed by occupying forces. I was suspended from posting or commenting for 30 days while my posts were reviewed. I believe that the closure of my WhatsApp account is about stopping me publishing my journalistic work.
Sada Social, an initiative that records and monitors the suspension of Palestinian content and accounts on social media platforms, announced that Meta had mainly targeted activists based in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Nida Basumi, the media coordinator at Sada Social, says there has been an agreement in place between the Israeli regime and major social media networks since 2016 over controlling Palestinian content. She also pointed to double standards imposed by Meta when it comes to censoring content.
It launched an intensive campaign against Palestinian journalists by restricting social media posts reporting breaking news from Palestine. But it did not restrict the Israeli forces' video showing them raiding Nablus and killing Palestinians.
Israel and its allies are not only pressuring big tech to silence pro-Palestinian voices from outside. Facebook's Oversight Board, an independent body tasked with deliberating on the platform's content decisions, includes a former official at an Israeli ministry cyber unit, Emmy Palmer. She personally lobbied for the removal of thousands of pieces of Palestinian content from Facebook.
You know, it happens to all journalists all over the world, to all people who are pro-Palestinian all over the world. We have to fight with that. It's not only the Palestinian social media. It's all social media and all the people that ignore the narrative and are trying to do their jobs right. It's all the people that try to communicate a truth that the narrative doesn't like, the main narrative.
Since the very beginning, social media companies have collaborated with centers of power in the U.S. They even collaborated with the U.S. Department of Defense on surveillance and big data analysis. So it's not just a few influential pro-Israeli voices co-opting social media companies into silencing pro-Palestinian voices. The industry itself is rotten to its core.
As the crisis between Russia and the West continues to get worse, Moscow's warnings against the West for its punitive measures against the Kremlin continue to get tough. President Putin has now warned that Western sanctions against his country are hurting the entire world. Putin described the sanctions as short-sighted, saying the West has undermined the global economy with its aggressive attempts to impose its dominance on the world.
The United States has been pressing sanctions against Russia, individuals, private businesses, and state-owned enterprises. The European countries, most of which belong to the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, have gone along with this and have imposed their own sanctions. They're trying to cut back on the importation of Russian gas because that provides revenue for the Russian government. But they seem to have suddenly remembered that they import 30% of their gas from Russia.
Putin also said the West has been reluctant to recognize that, quote, irreversible and tectonic shifts have occurred in international relations. According to Putin, these shifts in international relations have led to the emergence of the Asia-Pacific region as a magnet for human resources, capital, and production capacities. The Russian president further said that Moscow found more opportunities in the markets in the Middle East after the West imposed sanctions on Russia. Putin also attributed the unfolding global economic crisis to Western elites who, quote, would not or even cannot acknowledge objective facts about global changes. He further said the US and its Western allies have tried to isolate Russia, but, according to Putin, it's impossible to isolate Moscow from the global economic and political landscape.
The problem for the United States ruling class at this point is that the world is becoming increasingly multipolar. It's no longer a situation where the United States can call the shots every area politically, economically, and even militarily. China is the second, the world's second largest economy, and is that economy is advancing more rapidly than that of the United States, and the United States views this as a tremendous threat because it's an economic competitor. The United States has been involved in wars throughout its history, but certainly intensely ever since World War II.
The crisis between the West and Russia has triggered unprecedented shifts in international alliances. After the war broke out between Russia and Ukraine, the US and its European allies tried to put Russia into a corner by imposing a raft of sanctions against Moscow. They put Russia's oil and gas industries, as well as its banking and insurance sectors, under heavy sanction. But the sanctions now appear to have backfired against Europe. Following the tensions, oil and gas prices surged to unprecedented levels. The high prices were beneficial to Russia, bringing huge profits to its oil and gas sector. Furthermore, Russia has forged closer ties with China, India, and Iran.
So, and meanwhile, Russia is now selling more oil to China and India at reduced cost, but they're selling it. So it looks like the sanctions are not going to hurt Russia nearly to the extent that the West hoped it would, and they're having repercussions on the standard of living of Europeans and North Americans, which only goes to show how integrated we are into a global economy. The sanctions are not producing the effect that the West wanted to. It's not bringing Russia to its knees, and it is also having deleterious effects on their own economies and their own peoples. So I think in that sense, President Putin was correct in his analysis.
Furthermore, the crisis put European countries into uncharted territory. Gas prices are rising dramatically in Europe following Russia's decision to stop gas exports to Europe. Moscow has cited Western sanctions as the reason for its decision and says it will not resume gas flow until Western sanctions are lifted. The energy crunch is now hurting European countries. There are now warnings of a harsh winter in Europe. There are already protests in several European countries against high costs of living and soaring prices. High electricity prices are hurting ordinary citizens in Europe as well as major businesses. Germany, which is considered Europe's biggest economy, is now on the brink of recession. Experts now warn that an economic downturn in Germany is unavoidable. And the recession in Germany will surely negatively affect the economy of the entire European Union.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ardi.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم فاستجب دعائي واقبل ثنائي واجمع بيني وبين
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan, and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my Master, and my Lord. Welcome my friends, keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the folly, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam. So, dear friends, when we are talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam, we find that this living miracle of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, Imam Ali, alayhi salam, was truly a universal persona, because his characteristics, his behaviors, his morals, his ethics, his teachings, his knowledge, his wisdom, all of it was able to transcend time, and it is still very much applicable to the present day. Unlike many other philosophies and ideologies and teachings and teachers, we find that they have been lost in the pages of history, but not the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, alayhi salam. Now, in one place, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam has spoken about guidance, and he has told us what it is that we need to do if we want to be guided in the present day. And matter of fact, he has said in one of his sermons what we need to do to be guided in any age. We find that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, O you who from the companions of Noah's Ark have walked onto this earth with the divine will, know that there is the same flood and ark in our time. Hence, the only way for salvation is to seek refuge in the Ahl al-Bayt. If the people at the time that embarked on Noah's Ark and were safeguarded from drowning, you too will be safe from superstitions and deviations at this time by resorting and turning to the Ahl al-Bayt. I pledge my obligation to what I say, and I undertake to be accountable for it on the Day of Judgment. Truly, as we had said in our introduction, the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is a persona that is applicable to us in every age. Sometimes amongst the confusion and the darkness and the falsehood and the lies and the corruption and the deception, which we see not only on a local, societal, communal level, but also on a global level. When we see these things, we sometimes become sad, we become depressed, and worst, we despair and we become hopeless. Here, Imam Ali alayhi salam is saying that it is the persona of the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them. It is the persona of these living examples of Islam that can help us to crawl out of this darkness that seems to be engulfing the world. And so, not only does Imam Ali believe in this, but his level of belief in that it is the Ahl al-Bayt, the people of the house, the immaculate imams, who will guide humanity. Not only does he believe it, but he believes it to an extent where he says that he will be held accountable, or he will undertake the accountability of this statement on the Day of Judgment. And of course, we all know what kind of a serious day the Day of Judgment is. So Imam Ali is taking his words incredibly seriously, with all certainty and yaqeen. The guidance for humanity is and only is the Ahlul Bayt, the true messengers of Islam. A beautiful, comprehensive lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
In the name of Allah, assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafiya. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, you must not allow uncertainties and doubt poison your mind. Skepticism or irrational likes and dislikes should not affect your views. But remember that before you start thinking and deliberating over a problem, seek guidance of the Lord and beseech Him to give you a lead in the right direction. Avoid confusion in your ideas, and do not let disbelief take hold of your mind, because the first will lead you to agnosticism and the others towards errors and sins. When you are thus prepared to solve any problem, and you are sure that you possess a clear mind, a sincere and firm desire to reach the truth, to say the correct thing, and to do the correct deed, then carefully go through the advice that I am leaving for you. If your mind is not clear, and it is not as free from doubts as you wish it to be, then you'll be wandering in the wilderness of uncertainties and errors, like a camel suffering from night blindness. Under these circumstances, it is best for you to give up the quest, because with such limitations, none can ever reach the truth.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and that is the universal aspect of his personality. We are talking to the Shias. Alhamdulillah, you know many, many examples. We are just highlighting some of these examples just to for ourselves to remember those examples and learn lessons in our own lives.
When Ali was traveling from Medina to Basra with his army to deal with the rebels who had gathered in Basra, the Battle of Jamal. On the way, the army stopped in a place called Rabza. And there was a caravan probably going or coming back from Hajj, I'm not sure. But they were passing by and they came to know that this is